Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you very much for coming back. I'm still Kathy Fuller-Seeley, here from the University of Texas with a very bad throat, so I apologize that I will sound a little strange today. But today I have two fun talks to give you. The first one is an interesting bit of research I found that involves something as simple as a dish, but I will be connecting it to the history of movie going in the United States. It is another one of these local case studies of instead of talking about this sort of one simple American audience, everybody understanding the culture of movie going the same way, this is going to be a case study that talks about a particular time and place of the Great Depression, the hard times in America of the 1930s, and the ways in which small theaters tried to adapt to the difficult times by trying to bring audiences back to the movies, and what especially it meant for women. So we're going to be talking about the eternal war between women and men not understanding necessarily what women want. That'll be the fun of it. First, I'm going to start with a little bit of background that draws it. Well, remember yesterday I was talking about especially the problems that small theaters and large theaters had in the United States with the coming of talkies. Remember, this is a picture palace. And remember I said yesterday that when silent movies changed to talkie movies, to sound movies, in about 1927 to 1929, it meant initially tremendous prosperity for the movie industry in America. Movie attendance rose by as much as 40%. It was everybody in the movie industry was very, very happy. Money is rolling in like crazy. Especially benefiting were the largest urban movie theaters, the theaters that were able to install the sound equipment first. They got the big motion pictures first. They charged the most money. Audiences were delighted to go to them. You'll remember I said that this prosperity, the 1929 talkies, presented some challenges for smaller theaters around the rest of the country, not in the urban centers of like New York or Chicago, and that for the smaller theaters, it was expensive to wire their theaters for the sound. So that was a challenge to overcome. That their audiences, if they had money, wanted to go to the city to see a movie in the big presentation form at the major theaters. But remember I said yesterday that for a number of small theaters, it meant that they couldn't continue, that they had to close. So that was a bad thing. But for the other small theaters that were able to meet this challenge, they installed sound equipment and they too benefited from the coming of talkies to bring prosperity to small theaters too. Nevertheless, The other terrible thing that started in 1929 was the beginning of the Great Depression in America. It started in October 1929 when our stock market crashed. Stocks that were valued as much as $1,000 soon were valued at only $500. And that money in between just disappeared. People ended up, if you bought stocks and not very many Americans did, but if you were buying stocks, sadly what most people did was they were able to buy it for like $10 and put the rest, say, on their credit card. They were going to pay very little for that stock and hope to hang on to it just long enough as stocks kept rising in price that you could buy it, let's say, at $500 and sell it at $700 or $900, and by the time the bill came due that you had to pay for the stock, you could sell it at the higher price, pay back the person who loaned you the money, and keep the difference. So I want you to think it was very bad financing, but for the 5 years that the stock market increased in American culture, it was earning a few people a lot of money. Nevertheless, that while only a few people were actually playing the stock market and earning the money, it made everyone in America feel happy. It made everyone in America feel like our economy is just going great. And all of us are going to get rich. The economy is never going to go bad again. We're just going to grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. And this is what all the advisors were telling them, too. This is a tremendous lie. Nobody knew. And they just said things will get better and better and better forever. Well, that better and better and better and better stopped in October 1929 when the stocks had reached outrageous heights and no one was willing to pay more for them. Very, very rapidly, the prices just started tumbling and tumbling and tumbling. And as I said, all that money disappeared, but it was sort of imaginary money because people, as I said, had bought the stock on speculation, paying only a little bit down for it. But as the stock dropped in price, they were being asked now to pay the big difference. The stock market crash led many of the people who had been in it into bankruptcy. They lost everything they had. But even more than just the people who played the stock market, it sent waves of terrible economic collapse throughout the American economy. With all that money disappearing, banks called in all the loans. So if you had a home loan, you had bought a house, suddenly they wanted all the money for the house. Ah, you thought you had 30 years to pay? No, we need all the money now. You can't pay that, they take away your house. You're out on the street. If all you had was money in a savings account in the bank, if you'd never done one foolish thing, if you had been very conservative and just put your money in the bank, when the bank runs out of money, they close. They take everything in your savings account and just go broke. So suddenly you've lost all your money, even though you did nothing wrong. This is a picture of Americans standing outside a bank that had closed, that all its money had been drained away. And so everybody lost everything they had in the bank. It's terribly unfair. Eventually, when President Franklin Roosevelt became president, he installed cabinet installed new rules, new laws that insured banks that would eventually make it safe again, that if you put your money in the bank, even if the bank goes bust, the federal government will cover your savings. That only happened after 1934. Back in 1929 and 1930, when this was happening, there were no safeguards. And everybody, was, as I said, was losing big time. Not everybody was broke, but it scared everybody. So, as I said, everybody knew somebody who had lost all their money. And when this happened at factories, the factories had to shut down. So not only were people losing their money, but people started losing their jobs, too, as well as losing their houses when they can't afford to pay all of the mortgage in one big balloon payment. So I just want you to think that the consequences just get tumbling and tumbling and tumbling, kind of, it's seemingly out of control. It looked like the entire economy was collapsing. Nobody had ever experienced anything this bad before. And I just want you to think it was scary, perilous, terrible times, leading, as I said, people to run to the bank to try and get their money out, and they find the doors are closed and their money's gone. Just what you say was very, very scary. How that tumbled down, how that, let's see what I get to. Yes, so, as I said, the bad times just kept sort of spiraling and spiraling out of control. Within 2 years, a fully one-fourth or 25% of all Americans were unemployed. And on top of that, another 25% only worked a few hours a week. So, as I said, virtually up to 50% unemployment. Just devastating on American families. And these are some iconic pictures of poor people just sort of wrestling to try and get the few available jobs, at people having their farms and holds sold out from under them, people having to walk the streets wearing signs saying they will do anything for work. And pictures of poor people who have been dispossessed and having to live out in their cars and extremely worried about what would happen to them. Initially, to go back to the world of going to the movies, Hollywood still felt that they were safe from this. Movie going was one of the least expensive activities. And after the hard times started, many Americans started saving money, cutting back on expenses. But interestingly, Americans liked going to the movies so much that first they cut back other expenses. They quit going to sporting events. They quit going to Broadway theaters. Something like 80% of all the theaters in New York on Broadway, the live theaters, closed. Football games and baseball games, no one went there anymore. And empty ballparks. Vacation hotels saw no business. So I want you to think people were cutting back in many, many different ways, but they still continued to go to the movies. So for about the first 3 years of this Great Depression, The movie business thought that it's going to be okay. People are still going to the movies. Things are going to be all right. Well, come about 1932 and 1933, finally it hit home. And the hard times have just continued to get worse, and now people even quit going to the movies. This is terrifying to Hollywood. They, as I said, they thought that they had been able to avoid this, that the axe would not come to them. But nevertheless, it did. Movie attendance dropped. But yes, this is what movie theaters look like. They had completely empty seats. Movie attendance dropped by something like 50%. Now, at the height of the talkies, it had gone up 40%. So movie attendance both dropped everything that they had gained and started losing even more. So left and right, movie theaters are empty. Movie theaters are going bankrupt. But it wasn't every movie theater. The sad thing was, our friends in the small town theaters and the smaller theaters and the independently owned theaters were the ones who were worst hit. The picture palaces, these elegant theaters that were owned by the big Hollywood studios, by Fox and Warner's and MGM and Universal, these large theaters had corporate financing. They had a bigger base of financing and savings to keep up. Very few of the largest theaters closed, even in the hardest times. If your theater was part of a large chain, like McDonald's or Burger King, if the company owned many, many, many theaters, even if they're smaller ones, the company could spread out the losses across the theaters. And big chains were okay. The theaters that got the hardest hit were those mom and pop theaters that I had described yesterday, independently owned ones in smaller towns or suburbs. This is the 1-2 punch. Not only had they had the challenge of trying to adapt to sound, but even if they'd managed to do that, now the terrible hard times of the Great Depression were just causing them to have to want to feel like they had to give up. Especially the small town theaters were facing empty seats. I had found in the article, I quote a newspaper article I'd found in Richmond, Virginia, on the East Coast, that said 100 out of the 300 movie theaters in our state have had to close because no one can afford to go to them. There are no paid tickets. The theaters are having to close. I did some research, and there's some boring stuff in here about lots of figures. I wanted to show other American film historians that this catastrophe of closing American theaters did not happen equally all over the place. My research found that, especially in cities, largest cities like New York and Chicago, again, still there were enough people to go to the movies that those theaters could stay open. Maybe only 10% of them closed. But I found in sort of rural farm areas, especially around Ohio, Cincinnati, and that sort of central Midwestern area, all across the South, in the Plain States, the majority of the theaters were single owner and smaller, they got hit by as up to 40 to 50% of all those theaters had to shut their doors. Hollywood did not want to let any of this news out. Hollywood, the great PR agency, always wants to say things are fine, things are perfect, things are great. And so they did not put out this information. I had to dig in all kinds of strange little records to try and find this. And as I said, they didn't want to, it was like they were so humiliated, they didn't want to admit that times were that hard. But truly, this is what many, many thousands of American movie theater managers were facing. And if you're going to try and stay in business at all, you've got to try and get the people to come back and fill these seats. My question is, this was my picture to show that, as I said, I love a map. Now, if you get to know me, I love a map. And so, as I said, in the biggest cities like New York City over here or up in Chicago up here is not the problem. But this whole swath of the rest of the central part of the country, this is where the problem was the most acute. But if you're going to fill these empty seats, how in heaven's name are you going to do it? Theaters had three or four different strategies. One was to play up the movies they're showing. This is Ginger Rogers in a pretty outrageous outfit from The Gold Diggers of 1933. Money, She is dressed in an outfit made of coins, a scanty outfit made of coins. So what the Hollywood studios told the movie theater managers, it was not very helpful at all. They just said, try harder. They said, look, we're making movies. Just we're churning out movies. Just play our movies and things will be all right. Well, if you remember from yesterday, you'll remember already that the small town theater said, you're not making the right movies for us. We want movies with, like, Will Rogers. We want farm folks in our movies. We want little Shirley Temple. Make Shirley Temple movies. Don't give us elaborate historical epics. Don't give us gangster movies and crime. Don't give us sex pictures. Please give us things our audiences want to see so that they will come back to our theaters. So, like I said, some of the favorite movies we as film historians and students love to study about the 1930s. Elaborate musicals, gangster pictures, Marx Brothers comedies, all those kind of things, and a lot of sex films, were what were coming out, but they weren't necessarily helping our small-town theater exhibitors very much at all. So Hollywood is just putting out the movies that might play better at those big picture palaces, but are not necessarily helping. Other theaters tried to, that 15 cents represents a price cut. So other theaters said, if people have less money, if we charge less, maybe they will come in. If we make movie going a bargain, and so they all over the country, the price of movie tickets from their 1929 high, when the talkies were new and everybody was anxious to go to the movies, the movie ticket prices fell by almost 50%. So they reduced prices, like anything, to try and get people to come back to the movies. This worked some places. But it didn't work other places. It helped a little bit. But still, if you don't have any money, having movie tickets half the price they were before, you still can't afford to go. So, like I said, this was a bit of a panacea. This helped a little bit. But critics inside the industry worried. They said, if you cut the price when times get better and you go to raise the price again, your customers may be angry with you. They would say, what are you doing raising the price again? We've got used to movies being 15 cents instead of 50 cents or something like that. You're ripping us off. So they said there's dangers in cutting the prices, that if you ever want to take them back up high again, people will think that they're not getting a bargain anymore and that they're getting ripped off. Hollywood suggested what you need to do is not only to show our movies, but they said to individual theater managers, they said work harder. They said you need to advertise more. And so, again, Hollywood's not really helping here. They're suggesting that their movies are everything, what that people go to the movies for. And they said, this is a bad picture. This is an effort of a local theater manager who spent hours constructing and probably getting all his children and ushers and assistants to help him construct this elaborate display for the lobby of his theater to advertise the Lost Squadron. So, again, movie theater managers were being told, work harder. Get out on the streets. Bang gongs. Send advertising flyers. Make a big fuss. Tell more people about your movies. Make them want to come to your theater. Construct more elaborate kind of displays in-house. Other things that theaters did along the line of cut, if they didn't, but sometimes they both cut costs and tried to add more value to the show. So this is where movie theaters started playing two features for the price of one. What we call double features started taking off in the 1930s. So the movie theater would say, here's twice the movies for one cost. Come on in and stay all day. Bring your lunch. Really, have a good time. So they tried to offer more value to their customers. Hollywood hated that. They said, no. You can't show our movies as often if you make the show longer. They said, you'll cheapen, people will have less respect because the second movie you're showing is usually a very inexpensive, cheap movie that will drag down people's opinion of Hollywood movies. They said, put your money into our best productions. Well, even if a small town theater manager put their money and hoped for the best they could get out of Hollywood, if they could get a King Kong as one kind of movie, the best they could, the small town theater managers did love King Kong, but you could only play it for 4 days, 5 days tops. That may help you 1 week bring in your audience, but then you're going to have to show some awful stuff that Hollywood else has put out, and has put into those contracts that I told you about. Remember that I said the Hollywood studios said you can't just have one of our films. To get one, you must get all 52 that we make all year. So I want you to feel sorry for these small-town theater managers who had many limits on what they could do to try and make business better. You can't just pick and choose the movies that you think your audience wants to see because Hollywood is saying, no, you must buy all our movies to get the few that you actually want. They are suggesting just work harder to advertise them. They are not necessarily supporting your attempts to give added value by reducing the costs or doubling the number of pictures that you're showing. So small-town movie theater managers are in a real bind. What else can they do to try and fill those empty seats? Well, remember, we're still trying to fill those empty seats. Well, it occurred to them, it occurred to a couple smart theater managers, let's go after a certain segment of the audience. And they decided to go after the housewives, the mothers, the women of America. Now, as I said, they could have gone after, originally they made some of these other attempts like this. They charging less money would be charging less money to everybody in the audience. Offering double the movies would be offering something to everyone in the audience. So they were trying certain promotions geared to attract undifferentiated all the audiences in the world. But it was a different tactic to instead go after just the women. But it turned out to be pretty brilliant and pretty interesting to only go after the women in the audience. Because most American women were housewives. They were not, if they were married with children at home, they were not out working paid jobs. They were working endless hours unpaid in their homes. So these women were not being approached as head of the households who have the most money who decide. But the smart theater managers who started targeting the women said it's more complicated than that. They said it's the mothers of the family who choose what movie the family might go to see. So they said it was women, younger women on dates with young men. Maybe the women chose the movie more often that they're going to see. That girls going together would choose a movie. And that especially mothers and wives might, they found and they estimated, made the choice for the movie that the entire family would go to see. And so they said if we could target just the women, they might bring their men and their children with them to come out to the movies and to come to our movie theater. Well, what could they offer? They said, what kind of a special present, what kind of a giveaway, what kind of a gift could we offer to get these women to come to our movie theater? The answer is going to be that dish. So, as unlikely as it is, they didn't offer chocolates, they didn't offer flowers, they didn't offer dresses. They eventually offer cash, but they decide to offer dishes as the things that women might want. And I want to talk about the importance of dishes for women, for housewives in America in the 1930s. Well, as I said, for all, here's a little bit of my sort of feminist American history talking. It's really interesting to think about the lives of American women, the mothers, and housewives of America, having to make do in tough times. If your husband's income is greatly reduced, you're not going out to eat at restaurants anymore. You're going to have to eat at home. You're going to have to buy less expensive food, but you're still obligated, if you're a good mother, a good housewife, you're still obligated to cook all the meals. And you have to stretch that stretch your food bill as much as possible to try, and you don't want to starve your children. You need to feed and take care of the entire family. So in an age before packaged food, American women and women around the world spent much of their day purchasing or growing and preparing food and serving it up at the table and then washing up the dishes afterwards. So for women, it was an endless cycle of and something that they could be very proud of, something that could mean a lot to them, or something they could hate. And, oh, no, I've got to cook dinner again. Oh, Lord, it's lunchtime. So you could like to do it. You could hate to do it. But in American culture, at least, it was the women who day after day after day were in an endless cycle of having to cook and prepare food and serve it. But it's the serving of it that's really kind of interesting, because while you've got to do it all the time, Things as simple as plates and dishes could mean something to women. As I said, in these hard times, you certainly, if you only had five dishes and you had to wash them all the time, you got to know these dishes really well. As I said, even the poorest, the little children living in tremendous poverty here still are trying to eat off something. But I want you to think, and this may be true with your own families, your own grandparents or great-grandparents, if you know about this. I mean, if you think back, if you have families like this, the humble dish can be a pretty important thing. It's a sort of symbol of middle class, of gentility. If you're very, very poor, you don't have a matched set of dishes. You maybe have every dish, maybe dishes cracked or broken. Maybe you're having to drink your water out of a pickle jar and not a real glass. So I was going to say, it gets really sad. Dishes get, when you don't have very many of them, dishes and plates get used very hard. They break. They're ugly. And yet you have to use them over and over again. Well, here's another picture. That's a woman and her mismatched. I like her worrying. I'd like to think she's worrying about, are my children doing all right? Am I feeding them well? And things like that. For women in the Great Depression in America, they said times were very hard because they were the whole family had very little money to spend. And I have collected many, many stories of these housewives, of these women having to stretch their money so far and mostly deny themselves things because it would be as if I have so many stories of their children not having shoes to go to school in. Not it's that they're out of fashion shoes or they're dirty shoes, but their shoes are completely worn through with holes. I have stories of parents and mothers and fathers writing into President Roosevelt and his wife, Mrs. Roosevelt, and asking, can you please help me get my child a pair of shoes? My child has not been to school in 2 months because we live 5 miles from school and it's winter and they literally, cannot get to school without shoes. So I want you to think some families were so that desperate that they needed the very basic items of life. But if you were just a little bit more up the ladder, if you had shoes even with holes in them, they said personal possessions could bring a sense of comfort. But on the other hand, so much of what we found about these hard times of the Great Depression was that Americans took it personally. Most Americans did not have a good political sense. They were not their consciousness hadn't been raised by the socialists or the communists. And in America, no one was telling American workers that it was capitalism that is broken, that it's the system, that it's the it's the rich factory owners that are doing this to you. It is blah blah blah. Most Americans thought, "What have I done?" When the husband lost the job, it was, "What did he not work hard enough? Did the boss not like him? What was wrong with him?" So many women took these hard times very personally. They just said, maybe if I went to church more, this wouldn't have happened. Maybe if we were smarter, we wouldn't have lost our job. So I want you to say it's a very sad thing that very many Americans took this system-wide collapse and problem, but they took it very personally and they said, what have I done? I've done something wrong. This has happened to me. And that humiliation they felt, as they said, they did not see them, everybody gathered together in hard times because it truly not everybody was broke. A few lucky people were in industries that were still doing all right. Some men still had their jobs. Some families were doing well. And it was extremely embarrassing if it was your husband who's lost his job and you all are having to eat Spam, five times a week. And your clothes are getting old and they have holes and you're patching them and this is terrible, that you would feel so humiliated and it's so much your fault that you don't want to go out in public anymore. And so you won't go to the parties and you might not go to church and you're kind of hiding and scuttling because you feel responsible for your problem. As I said, it was not the situation of people banding together and saying, government, do something for us. It was individuals feeling inadequate and bad. And so, as I said, it was very, very hard for American women sometimes a community would band together. The women would band together if there was an important event, if a daughter was getting married, there was an important church or school supper, all the women of the community would gather their best plates together and loan them to the one family so that you could make the make it look like the one family was still prosperous and doing all right. So, you know, I went, and as I said, for people who had to cook and eat all the time, individual plates were really important. Oh, there's some African-American women. Again, I want you these pictures of how poor everybody was. But, as I said, what they're seeing in the movies, what they're hearing about, is that some people, there are still some people out there who are doing better than ever. And it was very frustrating to see, as I said, to go to the movies and see a picture of a family with a servant, with lovely china, with beautiful dishes and silverware and eating elegant food. It was very, as I said, people took it personally that this is this and this are the lives they're having to lead while other people have this going on. So that's the kind of background that would say why movie theater managers might pick on something like, what are you going to give women? What about giving them a dish? What's my next picture? Ah, yes, what about giving them a dish? Part of this, the solution of giving them dishes comes from the dish manufacturers. They were very smart companies that starting in the 1920s, there were dish potteries in America that both some made elegant dishware, but others made really inexpensive dishware like you would buy at a Woolworths at a dime store. And they made, as I said, they made lots and lots of really cheap everyday dishes. A few companies specialized in dishes that would be, if you went to the furniture store and bought a new dining room table, the store would give you a whole set of dishes, new dishes to go with this. If you to go with your new dining room set, if you opened a savings account at the bank, the bank might give you some dishes. You might be able to save your pennies and as a special sale, pay a very reduced price for a set of inexpensive dishes at the drugstore or something like that. So I want you to think dishes were out there. But as I said, so a few of these dish companies, one in particular I'll be talking about is the Salem China Company, helped movie theater managers come to this conclusion, target those women, target those homemakers. And they said, here's the idea. As they said, this dish here reads, every lady can secure a complete 52-piece dinner set in this pattern by attending the Texas Theater on Tuesdays and Wednesday nights starting November 24th and 25th in Far, Texas. The middle one says, each lady can secure a complete service of 52-piece dinner set in this by attending the Lyric in Athol, Mass. So, as I said, the dish company came to the movie theater owner and said, we've got an idea for you. They said, here's a giveaway, but here's a catch. You're not just giving away something once. What you're going to do is you're going to give this to the women only, not the men. And you're going to get them interested by saying, you're not just going to get one thing once, but wouldn't you like an entire set? If I have 52 pieces in the set and there are 52 weeks a year, maybe I can guarantee you will come. Once you start collecting, you'll want more. And I will get you to come for an entire year. It's genius. It's absolute genius. So, absolute genius. I want to tell you about, so, they said, so this is it. So this is the lure of dish night. Oh, every lady, it says free, is going to get a complete set. Who of all those poor women we saw before would not like 52 beautiful dishes? And all you got to do is go to the movies. Well, how did this work? How did dish night work? It's simple economics, but you can see how this is a great deal. Originally, so here's your movie theater manager with an empty theater. And the dish company salesman would come to him and say, let's say Monday night. No one goes to the movies on Monday night. On Monday night, you only earn $50 US at the box office because there's nobody there. You can hear the crickets chirping. They said, here's what happens if you start dish night. We sell you, for each week, 1,000 dishes. Now, each of these dishes that you're going to give away for free, each one of these dishes costs you 10 cents. And let's say you've got a 2,000-seat theater, but we sell you buy 1,000 of these dishes. That costs you, at a dime each, $110. So you have to pay out, yes, $110. But people are, you get so much excitement in the community that you get, now you filled up your movie theater and you just sold $300 worth of tickets, whereas before you'd only sold $50 worth of tickets. You get a great big audience, $300 instead of $50. And look at the math of it. That $300, if you take out the $110 you spent on the dishes, and even if you take out the $50 you've otherwise made that night, you made $140 extra dollars on what would have been the slowest night of your week. This is a good thing. Movie theater managers had no problem going, sign me up. I want this deal. The great thing about dish night was that you didn't have to reduce the price of your tickets. You could say for the regular price of like 35 cents, still every woman who comes will get a free dish. So you're paying, you're paying the regular price, but you're getting a free dish. And here was the hope that not only the women came to get the dishes, but they brought their husbands or their sons or their neighbors along. And as they said, so something like one third of the theater would still be filled with men who had also paid full price for their ticket and didn't get a dish, but they were with women who were very happy to get their dishes. There are pictures, and I will send some back over to stick on the website. I've got some at home. An entire theater filled with 2,000 seats with 2,000 women going, yeah! They are so excited to have gotten their free dish. Here, these women are rather sedate looking, but I want you to think of the excitement. I got something for nothing. That's what they think, and they're very excited about their dishes. So occasionally I found a couple, and here's one. They've got them back. The problem is you got to hold this plate in your lap now all through the movie, and sometimes they fall and break, crash on the floor, things like that. This is another picture. You will see little flat things. Everybody there has got their dish. And this is, as I said, incredibly popular. It took the dullest night of the week. It made everybody exciting. You brought home a dish. And it was very exciting and useful for the theaters. That Salem company that I mentioned to you is an interesting case. My mother's family lived in the area of Eastern Ohio where the pottery companies were. And I was there visiting her once and doing research for this because I found this material at the Smithsonian Institution, the American History Museum in Washington, D.C., where we've got the Star Spangled Banner flag and the ruby slippers Dorothy wore in the Wizard of Oz and other cool things. I was doing research there, and I found that they had gathered, they have a section of the museum on the history of pottery. But while I was there doing research on movie going and finding that sheet music and other kinds of things, and an archivist said, oh, Kathy, come and look at this history of pottery box collection. I said, why? And they showed me pictures from this. They had gathered some papers from this one company. And this is how I learned that this sort of small, obscure manufacturer of really cheap dishes made a bundle. And it managed to stay in business through the Great Depression through doing these dish nights. Well, so I was in Ohio visiting my mother. And I decided to do some research. And I found the name of this a prominent man who had been the chief designer, pottery designer, at another great pottery firm nearby. I called him up, and it turns out he was like 90 years old. He's a very old man. But when I said I was a university professor and I wanted to come interview him, he was very happy. You know, he felt important, and I was happy to make him important. And so I drive the 2 hours to his house, and I'm talking to him, and he tells me of his own youth. And I learned the story that he was 18 years old. He had just finished high school. He was about to go off to college. And his father and his uncle had worked for this. He lived in Salem. He grew up in this town in Ohio where the cheap pottery was made. And his father and his uncle were the chemists who work in the kilns, making, putting the glaze, doing the stuff of getting the chemicals right and the glazes for the dishes and blah, 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 blah. This young man, as I said, the summer before he goes off to university, gets an internship at his father's company there in town. And he wants to go to college to become a designer of pottery and everyday objects. But so he's there on an internship that summer before he goes to university. And he's just basically fooling around in the office. He's drawing things. He's filing papers. He's getting coffee for the people in the office. He's doing those kind of things. But he, as I said, he's fooling around. And he starts drawing on pieces of paper. And he says, it's 1932. And the Art Deco style is becoming really popular. And he says, I'm just playing around, drawing. And he says, it occurs to me, lots of people play bridge and card games. Lots of adults play card games. And they'd like to have little snack sets to put on the game table when they're hosting a card game. So why don't I play around with designing some snack sets of small plates and dishes and cups for these snack sets. And he said, well, the Art Deco style is all about strong lines. And he said, wouldn't it be amusing to have a triangular plate? If plates are supposed to be round, what if I made a triangular plate? And so he was scribbling on a piece of paper, and he basically came up with this design. And he was proud of himself, and it was a cute little thing. It was a triangular plate. And then he said, I need a cup to go with it. What kind of cup would look good? He went out to the trash bin where at the factory where all the mistakes were thrown into a pile. And he pulled out a cup shaped like this. It was extremely Art Deco, extremely rigid. Instead of a nice sort of softly rounded cup, it was an extremely angled cup. And he said, yeah, this extremely angled cup with a very sharp handle might look fine with this triangular plate. Then he says, what color shall it be? And he notices that the hot new fashion color of 1932 for kitchenware was an orange-red color. I'm addicted to that orange-red color. My socks are this color. It's because of this darn plate. I blame him for my plate. So he takes the new. So he takes his samples, and he paints them with this new fashionable paint. And he says, ta-da, I've done something. They don't pay him a cent. But he leaves it behind. He goes off to university and goes on to have a nice career at another pottery. But the managers at the Salem Company, after he's gone, they find his drawings and they see his broken, you know, his little cup, and they go, oh ho, let's do something with this. And they decide to make his design their featured line for 1932, 1933. This is what they sold to movie theaters to give away for free at the at Dish Night giveaways. And I just love the fact this is extremely modern. And here's the sad part for me. I like to try and collect it. Now, 70, 80 years later, I'm trying to find it on eBay in antique shops. Well, because of its very modern design, the antique dealers want tons of money for it. They want $100 for this plate. Remember, it was sold for 10 cents. And the antique dealers want $100 for this plate. Well, the plate is incredibly cheap. And you look at it, so you touch it there, and it's crack. I mean, so they are very, very cheaply made plates. But they're such an interesting design that, as I said, I have trouble finding them on eBay or in antique shops because all these wealthy designers say, oh, I really want this lovely antique pattern. And I love the fact that that young man who went off to college and became the designer didn't really know what had happened. It was only when I brought him this history that he said, really? That was my design. They took it and did all this stuff at movie theaters with it. I made an old man very happy by reconnecting him with this really cool dinnerware. He had gone on to design very elegant dishes in the decades later, but he was very happy to learn that something he had done at 18 took off. So I love the fact that Salem was they wanted to sell modernity, cutting edge fashion to some people, but that many other Americans were very conservative and loved old-fashioned Victorian things, 19th century things. This would have clashed tremendously with their old-fashioned looking furniture. So they would also take this very modern design and stick very old-fashioned things on it. Like this is a cross-stitch, a needlepoint design of Dutch figures. It's hideous. I think this is very funny. A very odd combination, a very new design and very old-fashioned pattern. But everybody in the 1930s was desperate. And indeed, they were giving them away for free. So that's kind of the fun of this. So, all right. So, the Salem China Company. So, they said, Salem, They come to movie theater managers and they say, as I said, here's this program, spend $110, make $140 extra dollars. Theaters everywhere start to sign on to it, and Dish Night takes off like crazy at the smaller American theaters across the country. This was not met with happiness by everybody. Hollywood producers, and I'm pretending that the map is up here and I'm still pointing to Los Angeles, but Hollywood producers were very angry about this. They said, stop it, you're not paying attention to the films. What do you mean you're spending your time and you're pulling in people with dishes? Because the other secret was a way to make even more money on Dish Night was, instead of renting the usual expensive Hollywood feature, you would order something really old, really terrible, really cheap. Because it didn't matter what movie you played. The women were here to get their dishes. They didn't care. As long as it ran and was some kind of movie, you could get by with it. So that especially made the Hollywood film producers very angry. They said, no, stop this. We want you to pay attention and rent our films. Quit doing this. So they said, you can, and when I did research in things like the trade journals and newspapers of the Hollywood film industry, I found no mention of Dish Night giveaways. They would not allow ads in. They put in articles going, this is terrible. You will never make any money. You will drive people away. This is awful. Do not do this. Did movie theater managers listen? No. They said, ha, we're going to do it anyway and have a lot of fun with it. I got to get back to that in a second. So they said, so Dish Night was extremely successful. But as they said, it brought up other competition. If you're a theater and you start doing Dish Night and you're making all this money, if there are other theaters in the town, they're going to be very angry with you. They're going, you're stealing all our customers. And so what are their options? They might start Dish Night too. Oh, no. And now you've got two. And so they're taking away some of your customers. Or they might say, you know, they might criticize you and go, oh, this is terrible. That's tacky. That's bad. Stop doing that. And not only did the Salem China Company sell lots and lots of sets of dishes by the train car load, Phil, to theaters, but once Salem started making money at it, all the other potteries started saying, we'll do Dish Night too. So I want you to think there was tremendous competition. The potteries kept fighting, no, we'll offer it cheaper, 9 cents per dish. No, no, we'll offer you 8 cents per dish. No, no, we'll offer you 7 cents per dish. So they said they kept a terrible competition up until you're practically giving the dishes away for free and there's no money in it. Too many dishes, theaters offering Dish Night, you might have it two nights a week. You might give away two dishes at a time. So I want you to think the competition starts and starts. And if you were one of these, if you were this big theater, remember this big theater? These big theaters hated the whole idea, because what it was taking some of their audiences away to the smaller theaters. Because even middle-class women didn't mind a dish. If you were poor, if you didn't have four dishes to put together, this was the most wonderful thing in the world. If you were relatively well-off, it's nice to have an extra dish. You use it as a coaster. You put a pot, a plant on it. If you were very wealthy, you play Frisbee with it. You give it to your children to play with the dolls. You give it to your maid. So depending on how wealthy you were, you had a different value on these free dishes. But they said the picture palaces didn't want to have to start doing things like this. They found it a waste of money. They thought it cheapened the experience. So they turned, during the Great Depression, when President Roosevelt became president, they actually turned to the government to try and stop Dish Night. During the very hard times, Roosevelt's government, to try and stop this endless cycling downward of the economy, tried to put a floor under things by getting all the members of an industry together into one room to discuss, let's cut this competition of 10 cents, 9 cents, 8 cents, 7 cents, 6 cents, will ruin everybody. And so for every single industry in the American economy, this government group tried to get all the people together and to do things like agree on what's the lowest price we're going to be willing to sell. Like for these dishes, we'll agree 8 cents, no lower than 8 cents. But the government organizations also favored the largest companies over the smallest companies. In the automobile industry, when they got all the Detroit manufacturers together, Ford and GM got to dictate all kinds of conditions that were favorable to them, and the little manufacturers like Chrysler and other little companies that have long since gone out of business got small crumbs. This happened too as the movie industry and the movie theater industry came together into these meetings with President Roosevelt's government. The big chain theater said, we're going to outlaw dish night, no more. And the little guys said, but now wait, it's working for us. We're making money. And the big guys go, uh-uh, too bad. It's not helping us. You're going to have to stop. So there was quite a lot of turmoil. So I want you to think dish night is successful, but I've been giving examples of all the ways that it was contentious and problematic, causing new kinds of competition and problems. Well, maybe sad for these big producers. In 1935, the American Supreme Court shut down all of President Roosevelt's efforts to gather the businesses together like that. It kind of like Obama's bailout most recently of certain industries. It kind of did it. It did some good up to 1935 of stopping that endless spiraling down. But nevertheless, the government got rid of it. And after 1935, anybody could have dish night if they wanted it. So that kind of restriction of forbidding dish night didn't last very long. But nevertheless, so even though dish night was legal, by 1936, there was a problem. People had a lot of dishes. It was not so novel anymore to go to a dish night. I talked to one woman who said the problem with dish night was it takes forever. You get one piece a week. You want a whole set of dishes, that's 52 movies you have to go to see. So, and I said, people were getting bored with dish night. It wasn't pulling, it wasn't bringing in big money like ever before. But something worse, you could either consider it better or worse, had taken its place. And it was dish, bank night. Bank night. Okay, what's even better than getting a dish is getting cash. And an entrepreneur in Colorado came up with this idea. And he said, I've got this scheme. There's in hard times, nobody loves anything more than cash. And so he says, what I will do is, he says, I will start this game at a movie theater. And how the bank night worked. See, that's a lot of $400. That's like $40,000 today. It's a U.S. It's a lot of money. How bank night worked was, and this guy patented it, Mr. Yeager in Colorado, put a patent on this. So you had to pay, each movie theater had to pay him a little bit of money every week to go to the scheme. But in this bank night scheme, there was no money involved. Everybody in the town had the ability. You went to the movie theater and you wrote your name in a book and you got a number. I would go to the movie theater and my number would be 1,032. And I would get a little slip of paper that my number was 1,032. Then on, remember that same dullest night of the week, like Monday, when nobody went to the movies, they would have the bank night drawing. So what would happen somewhere in the middle of the picture or at the end of the picture, to make people have to buy the tickets to go to the picture, the end of the picture on that Monday night, the manager of the theater would come out and he would have a great big barrel filled with all manner of slips of paper. And he would have a child come up out of the audience, reach in and get it and call out the number, 1,032. Ah! And they offered, as they said, quite a lot of money, maybe $100, $200, $400 to hungry families, quite a lot of money. But the trick was, if he called out my number, I only had like 30 seconds to get to the front of the stage to shake his hand to get the money. Now, so the theater would be filled, and theaters would be so filled that other people would stand outside, and they would have a speaker on the marquee, and everybody here, what's the number? So you'd have, maybe everybody in town would sign up for this. Maybe in a small town, you might have 5,000 people sign up for this. But if you didn't get there in 30 seconds down here to shake my hand to get the money, no one won. And that money was rolled over into the next pot. And then the money got even more astounding and desirable. And who doesn't like money? Especially, as I said, when so many people are unemployed or broke. It's this idea of a big wad of cash was just too much to be believed. Well, the problem with bank night, several problems and challenges here with bank night. One It was considered, some people considered it a lottery, and that was illegal. Do you all have lotteries here today where you pay a couple dollars, buy a ticket, scratch something off, they have a drawing, and you might win lots of money? Well, in American culture, the very Puritan, that sort of Presbyterian, that very old-fashioned religious belief, felt that lotteries were sinful, that it's terrible to get money from lots of people and give only one person a big prize and then who takes the rest, you know. So lotteries were illegal everywhere in the U.S. And so people who didn't like bank night, the authorities come in and say, no, you cannot have this. This is a lottery. And Mr. Yeager, the lottery, the bank night people would explain, nobody's paid any money. And indeed, you didn't even have to buy a ticket to the movie theater. You could, for totally no money, you could have stood outside the movie theater all night long waiting to see if your number was called. So they were able to fight it, going, no money changed hands. It's not gonna, it's not a lottery. It was a problem in every local town because bank night was so popular that everybody wanted to be there because everybody hoped that it was their number that was gonna be called. That anything else in the town stopped dead still that night. You couldn't have a church service. You couldn't have a PTA, a school meeting. You couldn't have a bridge game. You couldn't have a baseball game. Nothing else. When everybody had to be there at the theater because they were sure they were going to win. So, as I said, town authorities were very frustrated with bank night. Here, bank night, there were stories circulating that the one lucky person would be so excited. I just won $400. The other 2,000 people go, I didn't win. I'm angry. I don't like this. Especially the people selling dishes said, you know, women love to share. They're very community oriented. They hate to gamble. Women hate to be disappointed. Now, if you do bank night, and whereas it dish night, every woman gets a dish. All of us, yay! But at bank night, only one person wins, and everybody else go like jealous, angry. So, and again, the dish night people said, no, 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 bank night is terrible. Local communities said, no, 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 bank night is terrible. All these people milling around, on the other hand, gave rise to fears that how angry are they going to be when they don't win? There were a few stories of crooks hiding out in that crowd. And when the one winner with all their money goes home that night, that they rob him. You know, they knock him out and steal his money on the way home. So there were all these stories. But as I said, one thing that the authorities worried about the most was this idea of the disappointed American, of the disappointment. Now, at least, as I said, at dish night, every woman got her dish. But how much of this, so the conservatives worried that this was a very bad thing, that it made too many Americans hope for that get-rich-quick kind of scheme, that you could, you know, that somehow this miraculous thing is going to happen to you. And they're going, you shouldn't be thinking that way. Or that they felt that Americans would feel this sense of entitlement. Why should I have to take it as a personal responsibility? I will just hope for winning this $400. So they say, but most of all, cash night. There's more people outside of theater in Florida very excited about this. Here, one theater tried to split the difference. On Wednesday night, they would do bank night, and they would give kitchenware away on Thursday night. So they're trying to do both. This is pretty much desperate. But they said what some authorities worried about with that frustration over bank night of not winning, they were very afraid of violence in American culture. And there was a lot of that going on, certainly not like in Europe. As I said, communists and other labor activists didn't have as wide a foothold in American culture as they did in other parts of Europe. But nevertheless, the American authorities, the police, were very, very rough on the unemployed. There was a terrible situation in 1932 where American veterans of the First World War had been promised a little bit of retirement money by the American Congress, and all the veterans were unemployed and starving. And somebody got up the idea, let's go to Washington and ask for a little bit of that retirement money ahead of time. The government has promised it to us. We're just asking for something that's ours a little bit ahead of time. A couple thousand veterans come marching into Washington, And the police and the army are there with giant clubs, and they beat and hurt all these veterans who have fought for the American army. They beat them and chase them out of town and burn their sleeping bags and the little huts in which they were staying. So this terrible violence. But on the other hand, conservatives tremendously feared that maybe a revolution was coming, that maybe all this poverty, maybe all this anger was going to get out of hand. They said, so they found the crowds, the anxious and angry crowds, like here gathered at a bank night. They said, this is maybe a violent crowd just waiting to break into action. A few other conservatives also worried about what was being shown on movie screens. There was some stuff that when the newsreels showed pictures of violence, of protests, of unemployment, the people in the movie theater would get angry and start to riot in the movie theater, break up the movie theater, or even worse, to conservative community officials, come out of the theater and start rioting up and down Main Street. So conservatives, as they said, feared what was happening in the movie theater. They put pressure on movie theater managers, stop with this bank night. Don't do this bank night. Well, they said, so I just want you to think all these fears are going around. But nevertheless, for all this fear of violence, and there's a woman in a nice cloche hat running away from violence. Despite all these fears of violence, it was not necessarily thought that women were violent. Women love each other. And remember, dish night was given a dish to every woman. So no potential for violence here. But I found a very funny to me incident in a short story, in a piece of fiction that says, what if women too could have that sense of entitlement, that going to the movie theater for dish night had sort of created a kind of contract between the women in the audience and the movie theater manager. I've paid you my admission. You promised me a dish. You know, that's I deserve this dish. This is my dish. Don't tell me I can't have a dish. So an interesting example of that occurred in a story by an American short story writer, Gene Shepherd. The story is called Leopold Doppler and the Great Orpheum Theater Gravy Boat Riot. It's great fun. It was incorporated into a 1990s. If you've ever seen an adorable 1980s American movie called A Christmas Story, it's about the little boy in Indiana who wants a shotgun for Christmas, and they say, oh, you can't. The parents say you can't have it. You'll shoot your eye out with it. Watch this one sometime. It's a very sweet story, A Christmas Story. Well, they said the novelist tells the story. It's set in a small town in northern Indiana, which is undergoing the Depression, and the women don't have nice dishes. Everybody's kind of struggling to get by. And the stories all talk about the kind of absurdities of having to live in tough times when you still want and desire things. So in the story he tells, their local movie theater starts a dish night promotion. And they in the lobby of the theater, they put out this elegant collection of dishware. This dishware has pictures of movie stars on it. But the dishware is advertised. This is so much fun, I get to read it to you. Okay, there's that. Where is the... Well, all right, I'll get to the other part. But as I said, the movie theater manager here says, ladies, free to each of you, the dishware of the stars, this lustrous, pearline, beautiful dishware will be free. There is a 104-piece set, and if you come to the movies every week for the next 2 years, I promise you will get every piece, a lovely platter, beautiful cups, saucers, plates, bread dishes, all these lovely different pieces. And in Gene Shepherd's story, the women of home in Indiana who are bent over scrubbing their pathetic little plates are so excited. He says, you know, finally these women who have given everything to their children, struggling to keep ends meet and keep appearances up, they're going to have something for themselves, dishes. And they're so excited. So they start going every week to this movie theater to get their dish. Oh, they're going to have their dish. And so they're happily going along week after week getting their various dishes. And one week, they get a gravy boat. You know, it's the server for brown gravy or white gravy. So they get a gravy boat and they say, oh, this is the most beautiful, elegant thing, and they take it home and they're very happy. But a strange thing happens. There's a mix-up at the China production company. Next week, they all come to the theater and they're given a second gravy boat. And they go, this is very strange. What would I do with two gravy boats? Oil and vinegar, brown sauce, white sauce, cream, two gravy boats? So they go, why? Two gravy boats. Okay, two gravy boats. They take it home. They come to the theater next week, went in their dish, and they are given a third gravy boat. And they're starting to get angry. They're going, I know I'm getting this for free. But I say, but we had a contract. When I want that 104-piece set, I don't need three gravy boats. So they're going, and they're getting very angry. This is not what we agreed to. Third gravy boat. Fourth week, they come on, let's go. Gravy boat. This is unnatural. This is really bad. They've got their gravy boats. They're watching the movie. They're not very happy. The manager comes out on stage, and he says, ladies, I'm terribly sorry. What an awful mix-up has occurred. I'm so sorry. I know you're angry. He says, please, bring all the extra gravy boats back next week. I will have it fixed. I will have cups and saucers. I will have soup dishes. Bring them all back next week. I promise it will be fine. This is this manager. God, and they're going, okay. The fifth week, week five, they come back with shopping bags filled with extra gravy boats. And they come to the movie theater, and they're ready to get their other things. And what are they given? A fifth gravy boat. I have a picture of this. Look at it. Look how many gravy boats she has. She is not happy. Fifth gravy boat. The women are boiling. They are so angry. This contract has been broken. They are getting useless items that are not good. Five are not pretty. This is really awful. And they're sitting in the theater and they're angry to burn up. And so the manager comes out on stage again. Hi, ladies. I'm terribly sorry. I'm really embarrassed. And ladies going, "Rrr." And Gene Shepherd actually says that the movie that was playing that day was The Bride of Frankenstein. You see, with, monster. And he says that the manager's come out and says, I'm terribly sorry, ladies, and that the women up in the theater, and that they start acting like the Bride of Frankenstein, that they start hissing at him. And then somebody takes a gravy boat, and it's in their hand, and they throw it at the screen. They throw it at the manager. And he's, And that makes all of them do it. And acting like the Bride of Frankenstein, they're throwing gravy boats left and right at the screen. Great waves of gravy boats crashing against the screen, driving the manager out of town, ending the Dish Night program. It's a wonderful short story. Oh, that's where... But as I said, that's my story about Dish Night at the movies. The one thing, giving away dishes like this, as I said, although Hollywood didn't approve at all, both the giving dishes and giving money did serve the purpose. If we could get back to way back here, do you remember those empty seats? It did serve the purpose of putting people back into movie seats and keeping the movie-going habit all the way through the 30s so that the people would go see the 1930s movies. It kept movie going culture in place. Dish nights would no longer be necessary during when America finally entered the Second World War. Suddenly, our unemployment that had been so bad is suddenly erased. Suddenly, everybody has a job, and sometimes many women too. The movie theaters then stay open around the clock because if you get off work at midnight, they were willing to show you a movie at 3 or 4 in the morning. So, by saving the movie-going habit, these practices like dish night giveaways for these women, there, I'll go back to my dish, they did serve a really valuable purpose. But on the other hand, even dish night or bank night wouldn't have really worked if the movies ultimately hadn't been worth going to see. So Hollywood got very, very lucky that these smart, small theater managers managed to sort of get them through the hole of really, really hard times. And luckily that Hollywood was able to make enjoyable films that once the people started going back to the movies would keep them going back to the movies in a way that, as I said, would at least last through World War II. And that's where I'm going to stop for a little bit. So, how much early am I?
We have 20 minutes.
20 minutes, okay. You're going to let me get a drink of water. And what I want to show you then, because I've got some other fun stuff, I wanted to show you, I brought some material from an example of a movie theater manager who tried to do what Hollywood wanted him to. I found this incredible scrapbook. Escape. Okay, thank you. I found this incredible scrapbook here. Okay, so like I said, I love to collect material that has to do with, as I said, of the 1930s, of the many different ways that movie theater managers were trying to get through these hard times, whether it's by selecting the best films that would please their audiences, by doing things like having dish night giveaways to draw the women back into their theaters. Well, I found this scrapbook. I found it on eBay. An old woman had died, and people had cleaned out her apartment and thrown everything into a trash bin. This guy was digging through the trash bin trying to find things to sell on eBay, and he found a couple boxes of things in a scrapbook. Turns out that the old woman had been the widow of a man who was a theater manager there in Indiana, close to where Gene Shepherd, the novelist, lived. So he was a manager in a town of about 20,000 people, but he had big ideas, very creative ideas about how to increase movie going by doing lots and lots of publicity for a Hollywood movie on the local level. Well, in one of the greatest stunts he ever pulled, he decided to hold the world premiere of a Hollywood film in his town of 20,000 people in northern Indiana. He had to choose the film like 6 to 9 months ahead of time to be able to get a little bit of cooperation from the Fox Film Studio. This is 1937, 1938. He made the great mistake. How was he to know? He chose the movie called Blockade. It was a late 1937, early 1938, a Fox Studio film starring Henry Fonda and Madeline Carroll. It was, if it had been made 3 or 4 years later, it would have been Casablanca. And that would have been great. He'd have been shown one of the greatest movies of all time. Unfortunately, Blockade is one of the worst movies of all time. It is, like Casablanca, is set in war-torn Europe with these clashing sides. Are the Nazis coming in? Are the brave free French going to fight? Who are the collaborationists? Where are the Americans going to go? You know, sort of Europe up in arms in the middle of the great conflict that became World War II. Blockade, however, was set during the Spanish Civil War. And Henry Fonda and Madeline Carroll were supposed to be playing good country people, trying to work their way between the fascists and the loyalists, the communists and the Catholics. And they're telling this story of individual courage and groups of people coming together, and there's spies, and there's skullduggery, and there's espionage, and there's Nazis, oh boy, all the good stuff. But unfortunately, for the making of the film, American censors and the American Catholic Church came in and said, this film is terrible. Fox wanted it to be almost a documentary, ripped from the headlines, with all the latest news about the Spanish Civil War and what's going on. Let's tell America. Let's get America involved. Well, unfortunately, America was extremely isolationist during the 1930s. Most Americans put on big blinders. After their experience in World War I, they wanted nothing more to do with Europe. They didn't care what happened. Hitler could, you know, they're like Neville Chamberlain. Hitler can do anything he wants. And so most Americans demanded to know absolutely nothing about the reality of what was happening in Europe. So this producer, Walter Ranger, tries to make this movie, Blockade, talking about the current political and economic problems going on in Spain during the Spanish Civil War. But the Hollywood Censor Office, backed by these isolationists, started snipping away at it. First, they said, you cannot mention the name Spain. How can you have the Spanish Civil War if you cannot say it's Spain? They give it some faint, you know, some fake name, I can't even remember what fake name they get. So it can no longer be Spain. They can't call them fascists. They can't call them Catholics. They can't call them communists. They can't. So they then snip away all the names of the different combatants. And they end up making it such a sort of fairy tale of a mess of a movie that you don't quite know why all these poor civilians are being bombed by this side and that side. Why are they can't wear black shirts or brown shirts. They're wearing the green shirts. What? So they said, I want you to think the movie becomes an absolute mess. Well, my poor manager, Sid, what's his name, doesn't know this. All he knows is that he's trying to win a prize. There's a cash prize, kind of his bank night. If he can win the award from a Hollywood trade journal for putting on the most elaborate premiere, most elaborate marketing event of a movie anywhere around the country. So he's been trying out here with Bluebird's Eight Wife. Let me get to... look, he's got bank night. He's not proud. Look, $300 at his bank night. So he's trying everything. Sid's a... Sid, okay. Where's the regular theater appointments? So he puts in the... He includes all this material, and he has to work so hard. He draws up the advertisements, and he puts them in the local paper. He decorates trucks with advertising, and it goes around the town. This incredible scrapbook he puts together. I'm trying to get to the part. Oh, good. All right. There we go. So he's showing that film. So I just, he's got Charlie McCarthy. So I want you to think of all the trouble he's taking. If I can, I will eventually find in here. So he's got billboards up to 30 to 40 miles away from his town. And he spends the time and energy to order posters on the sides of barns, in farms, 30 and 40 miles away. He'll print elaborate programs to draw people in. He will go to storefronts and ask to cover stores with posters. He's got The Adventures of Ty. That's a terrible movie. Sadly, he goes all out on movies that are absolutely terrible. Like this one, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. Awful movie. Terrible movie. But he's got to keep pitching. He's got to keep trying. There's his truck again. There's a great big picture of Grandma with wonderful little Tom. A 24 sheet. Gangsters, he'll try anything. So you got a gangster movie, he'll do gangster movies. Where is he? This is, he'll decorate his marquee and tell us about it. There's more Bluebird. There's Claude. He'll sell, this is interesting for movies. He'll try every angle. So Bluebeard's Eighth Wife is a comedy about a guy who's been married 8 times. But so he'll sell the sex angle. He'll sell the movie star angle. He'll sell the hat, the fashions angle. What kind of, who made the hat that is appearing on Claudette Colbert's head? This man must never have slept. He just works constantly, putting in all his time and effort, just as I said, to promote to the people in his local area, make that it's impossible to avoid his advertisements, that everything is about the movies he's bringing to town. He makes every kind of connection possible to, here is what you can find in the stores. Here is the kind of toothpaste they use. Here is, why the movie is so wonderful and this and that and the other. So he takes pictures of, he has parades up and down the streets of the town for this at his theater. He does elaborate displays in the lobby of his theater that he's staying up all night building this stuff. As I said, stuff on a truck that he sends around. He's got Shirley Temple. There you go. Look, Rebecca Sunnybrook. Look, she's alive. Rebecca, oh, good. He puts colored pictures in the newspaper. He gives these away, signed colored pictures at his movie theater for Shirley Temple. He's got something. Oh, yes, he's very happy. He's got Mickey Mouse cartoons. He's got flowers. It looks like somebody's died. I swear, it looks like a funeral display. There's another movie. He's got Clark Gable. And so what I'm not finding here exactly, but as I said, if you just look at all these pictures, he took all the time to not only make all this stuff, but then to take big elaborate pictures of it all and assemble it all and together into this big scrapbook. The scrapbook is about this thick. And he sent it in to the publisher of the biggest Hollywood trade paper. And he ended up winning an award of about $1,000. Pretty good for him. But as he said, it represents months and months and weeks of constant effort. Here, this movie is about airplane pilots, so he fills his lobby with little model planes. Even bigger picture. He has, this is the local model airplane club. And he has these boys and young men come out on stage, and I think they throw the airplanes at the crowd. It's like, ah! So, yes, more pictures of the airplanes. So, more test pilot. He goes to every possible store around town and asks, could he put his advertising in every drugstore and every grocery store? He's got signs all over town. I said, it boggles my mind when you think of today at the multiplex, what kind of advertising does anybody do? Nothing. We're lucky if we get one poster in the lot, out in front of the theater. You maybe get its name on the marquee. You think that mostly today we learn about the movies we go to see through what? Other means. Word of mouth, somebody who's heard it. You read the review. You might see a big picture advertisement or a trailer when you've seen another movie. Well, they said back in the day, they said, look, the way many small town theaters did, it was you were supposed to be catching people walking through the town, going about their everyday life, and you're really trying to do anything to capture their attention on the streets or in the community. This is not assuming that they're going to hear about it on the radio or the television or other kinds of things. You're really trying to attract people in their very own community, which I think is kind of interesting. Here's at a shoe store and a barber shop. More ads, and he had to make these all by hand. On the studio, Fox and the other studios would send him some basic boilerplate, but they never did everything. A smart manager had to be a really good advertiser and cut all this stuff up by hand and write the copy and get it and make friends with the newspaper managers and get this into papers all around the town. Look at that, that's a lot of stuff. He gets special articles about the film stars like Dorothy L'Amour. Lots and lots of advertisements with pictures and things like that. All these happy, smiling people. Except they're about to be in a hurricane, so they're not smiling very much. So, her Jungle Love. That's one of the worst movies of all time. And to think that he has to try so hard, no matter what he gets from the studio. Her Jungle Love. My goodness. What a ridiculous movie. So on and on and on. So as I said, this one I like, even a strip of film. How nice to convince people that this is a great movie. So I just want you to think this. As I said, this was a huge photograph after photograph after photograph, idea after idea after idea. I'm going to, more things for old in old Chicago, I'm going to get an article about this, a scrapbook published in an upcoming issue of the American Journal of Film History. But it's an article about finding the scrapbook and trying to understand what the movie theater manager was trying to do in creatively using all these ideas. For a couple of these movies, I've been able to get see a copy of the movie studios would try to help local managers by putting out something called a press book. And it would be between a 4 to 20 page guide to all the special aspects of the movies. The Hollywood studios would go to a lot of effort. They had their own advertising agent offices inside. And they would lay out a fair amount of advertisements. Well, they would make banners like this. They would create posters. They would create some of the newspaper advertising that this guy uses. They would provide some blanks that you could stick in the name of the theater. But as I said, I admire about this particular manager is I can see the guidebooks from the studios, and he would never just let it rest with that. He was such a creative guy. He was always trying to think of what are my audiences interested in. Is there something about an industry we have in town that's mentioned in the film? Do I know that if particular kind of canned goods or clothing is sold in a local shop, then I will make the effort to go talk to that other shop owner, the ladies' hat shop, and make sure that I can connect the idea of the movie coming to town next week with the hats for sale. They said it was a full, it's a time and a half or double time kind of job to work that hard to make the local community of this small town of Indiana so aware of every movie coming to town and to have it connected so many different ways in their lives. But with the I'll send something back to you all that we could get posted on your website. When the article comes out, it's going to have a link to I'm going to have even better a selection of pictures of computer scans of these pages, so that you will be able to not only read my little essay, but look at all this material for yourself, and hopefully come up with your own kinds of research projects about it. Have I used up my 20 minutes? Close enough.
We have a 5 minute.
Let's go 5 minutes. 5 minutes. Good time for a break.